So, for example, in Dave Wagner's Caterpillar book, some of the hosts that they are recorded on, if we just test them on them, they might not do so well, but it, that's, again, only looking at it from a biotrophic point of view. If we include enemies and look at their actual performance in the field, that may explain some of some of the range in diet breadth and why some plants are still included. Alternatively, the effects of enemies could be very variable, and that's often what we see. And so there's this alternative idea that it could be unpredictability in enemy-free space on alternative host plants that could sort of promote a bet hedging kind of strategy from the point of view of these herbivores, where they're placing their eggs on alternative host plants because they're not knowing which ones are going to offer enemy-free space. And so it's sort of an evolutionary strategy that they could be using equally well. And to sort of formalize this, I put this into a model of thinking about how first and third trophic levels might influence host range evolution in polyphagous herbivores, because there wasn't anything else in the literature. So this is just my first stab at sort of a qualitative model. So on the left-hand column, if you look at it, it's just a qualitative measure of the amount of variance that's in fitness that's due to the host plant quality alone, just the biotrophic view. And then the right-hand column is the amount of variance in fitness among host plants that's due entirely to natural enemies. So in the first row, if you look, if plants are relatively equal in terms of nutritional quality, but we see a lot of variance in the levels of attack of enemies, we'd expect rapid specialization on the hosts that provide the greatest protection from natural enemies. Conversely, if quality's variation in quality is high, but it's relatively equal in terms of their risk of attack from enemies, we'd expect, again, specialization on hosts providing the highest quality food resources. What gets interesting if they're both high or both low. So what this model proposes is that polyphagy could be maintained if the covariance between these two factors across host plants is negative, and if the fitness in the presence of enemies is basically equal or nearly so across host plants. That's the way we might expect polyphagy to be maintained. If the covariance is positive, then of course there'd be rapid specialization on the hosts with the greatest combined fitness if both variances are high, or slower rates of specialization if variances are low. And so what we really like to do is come up with systems to test this model. And the system that I'm working on currently is a community of co-occurring sympatric highly polyphagous caterpillars in the family Limacodidae. These are all temperate caterpillars. They all have their wonderful counterparts in the tropics as well. There's about 20 species that commonly occur on deciduous trees in sort of eastern forests. And they all have a lot of features that suggest that enemies have played a big role in their biology. So several of them, or many of them, have these urticating spines that are chemically and physically that enable them to be chemically and physically defended. They have very long development times. They have very cryptic feeding, so they've evolved their head, as Mark showed in his videos. Their feeding can actually be hidden underneath their prothorax, because so there's very little movement even during feeding, which might be help against enemies. And some species have frass ejection to eliminate any potential chemical cues. So they're incredibly polyphagous, feeding on a wide variety of woody trees and shrubs. The larvae feed during mid to late summer and fall, and individual caterpillars are restricted to a single host plant during development. So unlike say the Arcteids that are running around eating a little of this and a little of that, these guys pretty much just stay on their host plant. So because they're actually more like plant parasites, we'd expect the full effect of feeding on a particular plant to be manifested. So selection by that plant ought to be quite strong. They take very long time to development. It's frustrating to rear them because it can take up to 90 days for an individual caterpillar to get through. That's an awful lot of changing leaves. The morphology and behavior appear to have been resulted from selection by enemies, and they experience very high mortality from enemies, especially parasitoids. The enemies that we've been looking at are a mix of generalist predators that are found on the foliage of these trees, and a bunch of mostly specialized parasitoids, many of which are actually turning out to be new species that haven't been described as we're doing a lot of rearing, and many of which are very similar to the same ones that Janssen's rearing in Costa Rica. The same genera, actually, of the tachinids are found in both the temperates and the tropical systems. This is just a picture of some of the common ones. And so one of the questions perhaps maybe differs my talk from some of the others is I want to use some of these phylogenetic approaches to look at, to actually map enemy association and use onto these phylogenies. We've done a lot of looking at host plant association, which is important, but I think enemies also deserve a little bit of attention. And so luckily, Dave Wagner did some barcoding of the common temperate species to provide a neighbor joining tree based on CO1 data for all of our assemblage. And what you can see is a couple of clades here that still need further support and phylogenetic inference. But there's one clade that appears to have these deciduous dorsal spines. They're not chemically defended. They don't appear to sting, but physically they have these deciduous spines that can be removed by predators when they take a bite. And then there's this large clade in the middle that I call the spiny clade, that's some combination of physical and chemical defenses, so tubercles and spines that are urticating for the most part. There's two species in this group, one of which that gradually loses its spine through development, and another in which the spines have been entirely lost except in the very first instar, so they'll figure in a second. And then there's a non-spiny clade of cryptic species as well. And what I did was look at attack by one of the most common parasitoids, which is the tachinid fly, which can attack as early as the very first instar, but the larvae are coenobionts, so they parasitoids, so they require almost the entire duration of the caterpillar development in order for the fly larvae to actually develop, and then they emerge very late in late instars of the adults. And when I mapped tachinid parasitism onto this tree, just sort of lumping everything, what we saw is the basal group was hammered by the tachinids. About 50% of them were parasitized. The spiny group was about twice as much as the non-spiny clade. And interestingly, within the spiny clade, the two less defended ones had the lowest levels of attack by this tachinid parasitoid. So we wanted to, since we were lumping across all the different host plants, we wanted to see if this pattern held for individual host plants as well. So we broke it down and looked at spiny versus non-spiny caterpillars in this group and their attack by tachinids. And what we found was the same pattern, that spiny caterpillars tended to be hit a lot more frequently by the tachinids than the cryptic ones in the same pattern. So that was on beech and red oak. So one suggestion that came out of this is, it possible, since these coenobionic parasitoids require their hosts to survive for a long time, could they be actually seeking out physically defended hosts in which to place their young to give them a measure of protection against being eaten in conjunction with their hosts by generalist predators? And so we tested this past summer. One of my undergraduates was really interested in this question, and so we did some predator arena trials where we looked at both assassin bugs and green lacewing nymphs, and they were given choices between spiny and non-spiny larvae that were matched for size to see how they would respond to these physical defenses. And what we found, just as we predicted, is that in these paired trials, that we found generalist predators much preferred the undefended caterpillars for food items. And even comparing spiny versus less spiny, we found a very strong aversion to the Acaria caterpillars, these ones down here, than Euclea, which is a little bit less defended. And so there was pretty strong indication that if in fact they are seeking out physically defended hosts, at least against these predators, those hosts are likely to be less eaten. So this sort of brings up this whole issue of larval crypsis and aposematism, and trying to understand the relationship between morphology and diet breadth. So one prediction we can make is that brightly colored defended larvae might be less constrained in their host use, because that physical appearance of aposematism may work against a variety of host plant backgrounds. So that's the kind of thing we'd like to map onto the phylogeny with a broader phylogeny, try and understand where crypsis and aposematism differ and what the consequences are for radiations of herbivorous insect. So it may be that cryptic species are under selection to become more specialized, or we predict they'd be under selection to become more specialized due to background matching. And then we could analyze this by actually comparing the variation in performance in the presence and absence of enemies among host plants for the two groups, and we're in the process of doing that. We also want to examine the relationship between herbivore morphology and defensive strategy and patterns of diversification, and we're going to continue trials with these generalist predators. So the limicotids also, some of the groups are actually gregarious. So most of them are solitary, but there's a few groups like Acaria that tend to be rather gregarious. And so some of this interesting social behavior in these caterpillars needs to be explored, and what role it plays in herbivore diversification as well. And Dan and Winnie have an amazing data set of limicotids that they've been collecting since 1978 at the ACG. And if we look at the limicotids in Costa Rica, it is exactly the opposite of the pattern we see for many insect herbivores, where there's a pattern of increasing specialization from the temperate to the tropics. Here, the limicotids are amazingly polyphagous. in their dry forest. So I put the line in again for the three host plant families. So these are a bunch of taxa, either genera or individual species, in which case they're monotypic genera. Just looking at the average number of host plant families they've been collected from, many of these taxa are feeding on routinely on 20 families of plants, which is really incredible. So this needs, I think, a lot of attention and explanation to understand what is actually driving diet evolution in these kinds of groups. And we haven't really just scratched the surface to try and look at those kinds of questions. And there's two groups in there, Venetocodia canedi and Epipyrola vaffarella, that are specialized within this group of super prolificous things. One is a fern feeding group, and the other feeds on Lauraceae. So it's interesting to, I don't know what's going on there. I'm sure Dan has some insights, but I think comparing these kinds of groups within a phylogenetic framework is where we really need to go. So my final thoughts are that adaptive radiations of insect herbivores are most appropriately viewed through a multitrophic lens. These tritrophic interactions in particular can drive an array of herbivore adaptations and can either promote or constrain patterns of diversification. Adding a third trophic level means there are many more ecological opportunities available for exploitation by these insect herbivores. It can be very fluid. We can imagine the herbivores moving through space, exploring alternative host plants, and enemies tracking and following them. But ultimately, those interactions are what are driving sort of the amount of space that these herbivores are actually occupying in terms of their tritrophic niches. We need, and finally, we need to examine the ecological interactions.